stream.
Well, go on to your PFC. It's definitely in your playlist. Your PFC.
Okay, why don't you start?
Okay. So, in Urban's presentation, we discussed a lot about a need for a different kind of science, and I'm not going to go into this discussion now, because I think we covered that, or at least we opened that question. I like to call this new kind of science in my theorizing, my thinking about it, I like to call it a science of being, not a science of consciousness, not even a science of experience, but a science of being. I have my reasons for that, and I hope I will have enough time to get to these reasons, but I'm not sure, because I don't know really how much will the first and especially the second point.
And it's not here, so
taken. Sorry?
Nick's not here, it's less, you know.
Okay. So I will have a little bit more formal presentation than Urban had, but please feel free to interrupt me any time you want. I mean, I think I might even function better if I'm in dialogue than if I'm presenting something. So my presentation will be about three points. I would like to reiterate or repeat the intent of first person inquiry, something we already discussed at Urban's presentation. Then I would like to ask, if we take this intent seriously, what kind of science can we have? So it's about a possibility of a different kind of science, and in order to understand what this different kind of science might be or how it might look, I think we have to get into the question of the essence of science. What does it mean to be scientific or to do science? And I think this will take most of my time. And if we have time, if there is some time left, I will go to this question of terminology, so clarifying or explaining how I clarified for myself the differences between the notions of consciousness, experience, and being. So if I don't go, if I don't manage to the third point, then we will just stay with the different science and we'll leave the science of being away. So we were discussing now the need for a different science, and there was Nick was really intent on showing, as I saw it, that actually you can do objective, you can approach with third person science every phenomena if you are persistent at it. So what does it mean? I don't believe that. I think we really need a different kind of science. And I believe this because, okay, if I ask myself what it is to do science or to be scientific, and I can say that in the first approximation, being scientific means trying to get close to the facts, to be true to the facts. But now, if we discover, if we see that there are some facts that change when being observed, what does it mean to be true to this kind of fact, to this kind of facts? So yesterday there was a lot of discussion going on about: are you sure that you're not distorting the experience when you're beeping or when you're observing it? Well, yes, you are distorting it, and that's a fact. And staying true to this fact means that you have to accept the change that you bring about by observing the fact, and not trying to escape this fact, or not trying to say, okay, let's make some methodological correctures so that we don't have this methodological problem. So I believe that experiential facts belong to this category of facts. So when I observe my experience, I change it by observing it. And so I cannot have, or at least I do not want to have, a science that would try to escape this fact. So I must take seriously into consideration, what can I do if the facts I'm studying are being changed by my observation of them?
Can we have a dialogue?
Yes.
I mean, it's interesting. I think you're right. For example, when you observe your experience,
yes,
you probably change it, inevitably change it. But if I observe you experiencing, I'm not changing your experience. Mm. And so some ways the third person may have a more theoretical access to your experience.
But can you observe my experience? That's the question.
I can in many ways I can. I can observe, you know, I can observe the...
How do my feet feel now?
I mean, there will be ways and means which I can...
How do my hands feel? I mean, you don't have this access.
But I do sometimes have access because you're changed by your experience. And I'm only suggesting that in some ways the third person has a more pure access to that than the person... Then if I ask you to introspect, so certainly that begins to change things. You can't. Now, supposing you were having sex now or something like that, and then you were beeped and you were learning how to come out. Okay. Right?
He's discreet.
in that case, you know, your first person commentary would certainly undermine the actual experience. But a third person observing you through a people might have accurate way of meeting what
you're going
on, why is mirror neurons and
everything
else.
Yeah.
Actually, Matei told me the joke how
the joke.
Behaviorists having sex and then after sex, how would that feel? But I'm sorry, you weren't there first day. There was this guy having fantastic presentation about the loneliness of the consciousness. And
I think this is settled.
So,
the other point I want to make in relation to your question is that there are facts that really are not, if you take seriously this existential importance of the research, there are situations that are uniquely mine. I mean, there can be other people in similar situations, but they are not in my situation. And it is only I that can have the full access to the whole of situation and have to decide accordingly. And so I need some kind of knowledge, or I need some kind of being able to do something with this situation. And nobody else can help, and no statistical approach can really solve the problem for me. So this is what I'm talking about. So to reiterate this, what the intent of first person inquiry is for me, or should be, I don't believe it is only about inquiry being done from the first person perspective, but it is about the inquiry being done for the first person. So it is done out of the motivation of the first person, for the first person, and necessarily from the first person perspective. So, if we take this, if we accept this this first postulate, as I can put it, then there is a question of what kind of science can we make this postulate. Okay, I wanted to say another word and I have it on the tip of my tongue, but it doesn't come out. The question is now, okay, what does it mean to be scientific? I think in such discussions, usually it is, we presuppose that we know that something is scientific and something is not scientific. But do we really can explicate this? What does it mean? Okay, rigor is one word that comes to mind. Science has to be rigorous in opposition to just waving hands, to use Urban's expression. But the only kind of... So we have to inquire like phenomenologists do, like employing imaginative variation. We have to inquire into what is the essence of science. I mean, what can I take out and it will still remain science? So it might turn out that the science we know now is just a particular, a specific example, one example of a much wider phenomenon that... Maybe it is the only kind of science we know, but maybe we can get to some essence and then build another kind of science that conforms to that essence. And since we have the science we have is the only one we really have. I mean, the classical third person science is the only one that we really have. We have to try to abstract from this science what does it mean to be science. This is my attempts. I will just show you how I did it, and so you might agree or not. So I think that there are three crucial features of being scientific. The first one is I think that the most important cultural innovation that modern science brought to humanity is the notion of individual epistemic autonomy.
Would you say that again? I can't read it. See it.
Individual epistemic autonomy.
So it's the belief that or an attitude that I don't take anything for granted. I don't believe anything that I'm told. I want to look for it for myself. I want to make sure for myself. And I believe, I trust, the only thing I trust is my perception and my reason. And that's what I think I mean by individual epistemic autonomy.
Doesn't that precisely not describe how the large majority of the scientific community, not to mention the world community in their relation to science, are, because hardly anyone takes their beliefs in science from their own individual...
Yes, very, very good. I will get to that.
Okay.
I will get to that. But I think you can... There are examples of, let's say, Renaissance scientists like Da Vinci, who did everything by themselves. Yeah. I mean, they went from the scratch and built everything. So now we don't do that anymore.
They relied on their colleagues for some things. I mean,
okay, I think that maybe not in every single experiment, but the possibility has to be there.
I don't think Da Vinci worked out Euclid's elements again for himself, but maybe he did. I don't know.
Okay.
He wouldn't have needed to.
Okay, I don't want to argue with that. I just want to say that the possibility has to be there. I mean, for something to be accepted as scientific finding, there has to be a possibility that everybody is able to go and check it out. This possibility has to be there. So, from this, there is the second point, and this is intersubjective, inter-individual.
Would you say again, please?
Yes,
your writing is behind the stove there.
Could you bring the whiteboard
up? Maybe. Individual regulations.
How about the state while you're up? Individual regulation?
Inter-individual regulation.
Inter-individual regulation.
So, Marty, is it fair to say that the first one is that anything can be questioned, or there are no secret cows?
Yeah, that's it. But from this, it happens that, okay, I imagine two scientists, and each one has this individual epistemic autonomy.
And now, one scientist gets to a conclusion, and the other one says, okay, I don't believe you, I have to test it for myself. But, in reverse, one can also think, okay, I know that he will have the same attitude toward me. So, if I find something, he will not believe me. He will try to test it for himself, because I might be wrong. And when I get to this, I sort of make a distance toward my own individual epistemic autonomy. Mm-hmm. So I'm prone to renounce my individual epistemic autonomy in favor of inter-individual regulation. Mm-hmm. So now, but this is still the basis of this, because I know nobody will accept my findings just because I said it, so I will also have a distance, develop a distance towards my own findings, because I might be mistaken. So, this is the second crucial component of, I believe, of what it means to be scientific. And because we now know that every, in principle, every scientific finding is inter-individually regulated as much as possible, then the third aspect of science is possible, and this is collective accumulation. Now I get to your point. Precisely because I trust that every finding was regulated inter-individually, I can build upon something that was already discovered. And this, eventually, as science becomes more and more institutionalized, this brings us to an interesting paradox that this, exactly, is beginning to wane, it's beginning to fade away.
Mm-hmm.
Because nobody really has the chance anymore to
and
go.
Also, the trust is also gets frayed as well.
Probably, yes.
And then, well, anyway, but yeah.
Okay. So, I think that these three features are crucial for everything, every approach that would want to call itself scientific approach. So, it has to have some sort of individual epistemic autonomy, it has to have some form of inter-individual regulation, and it has to have the possibility of collective accumulation. So, now the question is, if I'm interested in the first-person fact, in experiential facts, how do these three features apply? This is the question I'm going to explore now. So, as far as in the individual epistemic autonomy is concerned, mm-hmm. it is obvious that this autonomy is much stronger in the first-person exploration than in the third-person exploration. It is not only that I have the possibility to go and check everything, but it is also the fact that it is only I who have the access to some sort of data. Nobody else has the access to that sort of data. So it is a stronger kind of individual epistemic autonomy.
Actually, it's even stronger than that, because you have to do it. Whereas in third person, like in science, you can rely on collective accumulation, but every step you have to climb yourself.
Very good point. Yeah, very good point. In the first person science, it is you cannot say, okay, well, we were discussing this on the way here with Urban, this things, and at a certain point Urban said, okay, but now I know Merleau-Ponty already realized all that. And then I said, okay, but from my first person perspective, it doesn't matter, because I have to realize it myself all over again.
Right.
It doesn't matter if somebody else already did it.
I can't see why you're applying such stronger criteria of viability to first person case to the third person case. I mean, I cannot understand the mathematics behind, you know, Einstein's, Einstein's rejection of Newtonian mechanics. I wasn't trained in a way that equips me to do that.
Yes.
But, you know, I can still trust the enormous cultural pressures upon me, which come from the scientific community, mediated through the larger cultural community, that relativity has a greater chance of being true to the extent to which it disagrees with Newtonian mechanics than Newtonian mechanics as a complete explanation of the physical world. So I'm taking a lot for granted there. But I'm taking it for granted because of the enormous number of people that I trust, and people that people I trust, and people that people I trust, etc.
But
bed as many times as you like.
But
yeah,
in principle, if you decided now to leave all your career and everything and study for 10 years Einstein relativity, I'm sure you would be able to grasp the mathematics behind it. In principle, you have this possibility.
But maybe I do. Maybe I'll never do it because maybe probably my ability to understand mathematics just will never enable me to do that. And anyway, even if I could do it, maybe I haven't got enough time left in my life.
But this is okay. But
so
what you are talking about is a quantitative. It's a quantitative difference. I mean, it would take for you 100 years to get to what Einstein it took for him. I don't know, 10 years. I don't know. But in principle, you cannot, however hard you try, you cannot now know how my.
What about my son who's dyslexic
and
couldn't, you know, can't even sort of multiply two numbers together?
Yes.
I mean, he's never, you know, even in principle, going to be able to do it because of his, you know. But what about people who are colorblind, you know, trusting theories of color vision, you know, what people say.
That's just what you do as a social creature.
Sorry?
I said that's just what you do as a social creature.
That you just
decide to accept certain things.
Exactly. But then why can't you decide to accept that if, you know, if you see, you know, you have certain findings about your own experience, and you see lots of other people who look very much like you, and you have some theoretical suppositions about biology, about what goes on in people's brains, about, you know, similarity of anatomy. Not that you've ever seen your own brain, of course. You take that on trust. You haven't even seen your own head. You take that on trust from looking at yourself in the mirror. You know, why can't you just take, why isn't that just as much a part of a sort of, you know, the trustworthiness of science, and say, well, you know, I can see from my own case how my consciousness works.
I see
lots of other people very much like me in all the relevant respects.
Okay, I see your point.
You know, we all kind of go along with, you have to accept a vast, enormous amount of stuff on trust, but every once in a while, we all find out that, you know, as in the E. Cummings poem, there is some shit I cannot eat, you know, and you begin to...
But what is this in this case?
It's really very closely related to the first, this first point, to the intent of first-person inquiry, as I explained it before. Because if you're taking first person inquiry not about try to understand what consciousness is and how it works, but it's about myself navigating through life. So if I'm confronted with a life changing decision, okay, should I take this career opportunity or should I take that one? There is no one in the world that can answer that question for me, because nobody is in the same position. So in this sense, it is very much stronger epistemic autonomy. It is only I that, after a certain time of deliberation, then I get to a certain time with of sticking with the question, then that I come to let's say some kind of knowledge. Okay, I'll take this path and not this one. And there is nobody that can tell me. There is of course people that went through similar processes and that can help me
right.
in deciding. But ultimately, I'm on my own, as I am on my own in my death. I mean,
you're comparing this to the first person case of, you know, how can I know about other people's minds? Is that a similar? Are you saying it's a similar kind of?
Well, wait, why is that a first person question? It's not a second person question.
Oh, okay, but.
But let's take Steve's example. The son is dyslexic, son can understand, there are many areas in which I am effectively dyslexic because in relation to consciousness, because I don't happen to have the right kind of body. I can't know what it's like to give birth, for example. So, but I am quite prepared to take other people's evidence for what it's like to give birth as mediated through novels, poems,
But giving birth will never really be an existential question for you, because you cannot do it.
It's a question for you.
Won't it be propositional for you rather than whatever, perceptual?
You will never have to decide whether to abort a child or not.
That's a different question. The question of what it's like to be going to labor is a very interesting one to me.
It's an interesting one, but it is not existentially important for you. I'm sure. It is not existentially important in the sense that it's existentially important for a woman that is that knows that she got pregnant and now has to decide what to do. Do I want this child or do I not want this child?
It could still be existentially important if it's mixed wife or daughter or
yeah, okay.
But I understand your point. I just think you shouldn't try to confine it only to the existential. It seems to me that you want to broaden it out. It does seem to me that all sorts of first-person experience you really have to experience for yourself. Somebody gives you a wonderful theory about how things are in consciousness, and you say, that's a wonderful theory. And then you have to grok it for yourself.
Mm.
You know, it has to become a part of your experience. Maybe simply in reading it,
mm-hmm.
you say, yes, it just immediately clicks. And from then on, that's a part of your first-person experience. But still, the point of individual epistemic autonomy, I think, holds. So I just think you don't want to confine yourself only to existential situations.
It's not confining. I think if we lose that,
mm-hmm.
We will lose the power that drives first-person inquiry.
Okay.
No, I think we just opened up a really important issue. That kind of relates to what Nick started us off with, mm-hmm. in a sense, about that sort of social versus aloneness interaction, and leads to I think if we stick with it a bit more, to a really convincing answer to why do first-person research.
Well, let me just take another example. I mean, in the consciousness studies now, it's becoming very popular to adopt let's say Buddhist methods of first-person inquiry. And okay, we are here in the Buddhist retreat center and so on, so it's very closely connected. But what people often tend to forget, in my view, is that Buddhism is based on four simple truths, and these truths are all about human suffering. So it is a tradition that endures for 2,500 years because each individual has the existentially important motive to end his or her own suffering, and not to be just curious about how consciousness works. And because of this existential importance, a lot of knowledge developed about consciousness. But what was driving this pursuit of knowledge was this existential importance. So this really first-person existential importance of my own suffering, of trying to end my own suffering.
I think it's interesting, and it's interesting that you're putting the Buddhist inquiry in such a sort of narcissistic, self-serving way, because I actually think the chief, most people, the goal of inquiry and spiritual inquiry is to understand other people. Why do I read novels? Why do I dream? Why do I spend so much time thinking about what it would be like to be in someone else's place? It's not in order to end my own suffering, it's to understand, it's like Susan or Jack or whatever it might be, because these are the people who really matter to me, and I'm ignorant of what it's like to be there.
I was not just giving an example of a really successful line of first person inquiry into consciousness. And this line is no doubt based upon trying to end the suffering.
I
don't know about you, but
also may be a false science. I mean, it's been a successful science, but I mean, one could raise questions about Buddhist conclusions.
Yeah.
You know, in light of present day understanding, it would say, yes, it's been successful for 2,000 years, but we're now coming to some understandings that would say that the implicit idealism or dualism, depending on which Buddhism and how you read it, is wrong. And therefore, some of the propositions within Buddhism are wrong. And therefore, a first-person science that we might forge might have to now take an Einsteinian path around a Newtonian science, you know, in effect, take a first-person science that digresses in some respect from the first-person science that was Buddhism.
Because this all was meant to say, as you were talking to it, suddenly realized me, I've done a kind of flip here, because I spent 20 years of my life arguing that the only access we have to what it's like to other people is through our first person experience. Yeah. Therefore, we have to, it's almost our duty, and we've been set up by nature to guard and push the limits of our own experience with the object, implicit object, of being in a position then to see, as if from the first person point of view, what it's like to be someone else. And I think, you know, and it's a lesson which we learn again and again and again, that we can't actually predict or understand other people on the basis of behaviour, of third-person knowledge of their situation. Unless we've been there ourselves, we just make very bad psychologists.
Yeah.
And so, although I wouldn't call this first-person science, it's first-person exploration, which turns out to be crucial to what is in effect a science, which is the science of psychology. I've called it natural psychology, but, you know, it's the idea that it's, you know, that we have to do it by putting ourselves in someone else's shoes is, you know, I think pretty well established now. So theory of mind and so on have sort of caught up with the idea that you don't understand other people's minds until you've got access to the concepts through having experienced them yourself. So there's a meeting, really. I mean, there's a meeting of a particular explanation of how we, you know, a particular account of how we operate in the world in trying to understand and explain others, which suggests that the only route to that is going to be through first-person methods of inquiry. And therefore, if it was needed, you may say, of course it wasn't, therefore justifies and explains the energy we should put into first-person methods.
Nick, let me just say one thing. There was a book written back in the 80s. It was not a great book, but it was about somebody trying to present Buddhism from an existential perspective. Stephen Batchelor, he's in England, actually. But I thought the title was great, and it's just perfect for what you're looking for. The title of the book was Alone with Others.
Mm-hmm.
We should allow you to make the points that you
sorry,
want.
Sorry.
It's okay, but maybe I'm a little bit pushing it with saying that this is the only motive that, I mean, maybe the other people have another. So I will really make it first person now.
Only person.
I don't know about the only person, but I will try to say about the person. Okay, so if we grant this, that there is this individual epistemic autonomy, and that this is stronger than the classical science, then the question becomes: what about inter-individual regulation? What kind of inter-individual regulation can we have when we have such a strong individual epistemic autonomy?
Mm-hmm.
So, such regulation obviously cannot be anymore about the content of our finding. because, I mean, if we are looking at an object, object, we can okay, I see it red, and then you say no, I don't see it red, and some other people say okay, I also don't see it red, and then I start sensing okay, there must be something wrong with my eyes. But if I, let's say, make a personal decision in life, there is nobody that can really tell me this was a wrong decision. I mean, it's in principle they cannot tell me that. I mean, I can find it out that it was wrong, or I don't know, that it had a certain consequences. So the inter-individual regulation cannot be about content of our findings in the first person, but what it can be about is about the way we proceed to go into first person exploration. And what I mean by that is that there is a paradox involved here in this intent. I mean, the intent of first person inquiry, as I take it, is a very personal intent. I want to do it because I have some issues that I want to understand in myself or in my life or in my relationships with other people and so on. But if I'm focused on this change, I want to change something, then, as we discussed it before, I become somehow there is a French saying that I don't know how to say it in French, but in English translation would be, the more it changes, the more it stays the same. Exactly. what I believe is that the trick here in the first person inquiry is to realize that to adopt a really like Urban was saying, this wandering position, this just looking position, that the trick is to realize this is the best way to end suffering, that if you go directly, okay, you start by, your motivation is because you suffer, you want to understand something in you that makes you suffer, let's say. And if you go about ending the suffering directly, you will just fall into a pattern of repeating this suffering. So what you need to do is to see that what is required is a step back. So if I'm looking at the whole process, the process dissolves. And so it's paradoxically the suffering ends when you do not try to solve it anymore. And so inter-individual regulation can be really about remembering each other what we are doing, that
reminding each other.
Reminding each other about this to change this this attitude toward first person inquiry, to change it, not to be obsessed with your own suffering, but just try to look at it. I think this is where individual regulation.
It's not necessarily suffering. I mean, just
well, yeah. Okay. I was in this
spot
as an example. Yeah.
Which in another way of saying it is nurturing each other's inquiry. Okay. Supporting and nurturing each other's inquiry.
Yes. Supporting, making a space when this inquiry can be done safely.
On the basis of what? On the basis of shared convictions, such as suffering, for instance, or
it's beginning to sound like a self-help group.
We've heard that a lot.
That's a good point. But it is well.
Does it need to be that? I mean, can it be something very general? I mean, each of us here is interested in first-person inquiry, but I'm not sure that we're all interested in it for the same reasons. But we all recognize that there is something valuable in moving that project forward, both in ourselves and, we believe, collectively. And even though we may have different intents, maybe in my case I'm neurotic and I'm trying to, you know, deal with the suffering my neurosis is creating, and maybe in somebody else's case there's some scientific issue that's just nagging at them and they need to solve that. I in the end don't care, you know, why you're doing it. I just think there's something not only just valuable, but essential about this, and I want to nurture that in a community, regardless of your having to share my meaning for that journey.
About this self-help group, we had a discussion with Russ yesterday at dinner, and he said that he sometimes does his deeping research for therapy reasons, but that, as I understood it, but that really the best therapeutical results come when you do it for scientific reasons. When the people don't have this, when people don't have this, this need to solve some problems, but they are just looking. And I think this paradox we have to know how to grasp it, how to put these things together. So if we leave out this first person need to solve a problem or to okay, let's say end the suffering, then we lack the fuel that propels us. But if we forget that we have to just look, then we get obsessed with our problem, and then we try to help, and then it becomes a self-help group. So if we forget this, it is only curiosity. It's only okay, I'm just looking. It has no real direction. Our research has no real direction. But so we need this personal motivation. But then, upon this personal motivation, we have to make a space. We have to make a space that allows to just look at the thing.
So this is like a variation on what came up in the last presentation, I guess it was. From my point, so I'm sorry, I'm going to just repeat it. About religion and science, right? Or mystical insight, you know, and saying, well, if it's just self-transformation, that was the language. If it's just self-transformation without the drive to know, then that's incomplete. And if it's just the drive to know without some interest in an impact on the self, then that's also incomplete.
Yes.
It's so the same thing is true in the therapeutic situation you're discussing now.
Yes, I don't really want to talk about therapy anymore, because therapy, when you say therapy, you say disease.
Yeah.
And when you say disease, you're not inquiring anymore. You're happy. And that's the point of that. So, on the basis of these two points, what kind of collective accumulation can we have in this new kind of science? It obviously cannot be about a growing body of knowledge, because each one inquires for themselves. So it doesn't matter if somebody else really got to some conclusion, you have to find it for yourself again, all over again. So collective accumulation, in my view, has to be understood, should be understood, in terms of a...
I'm sorry, I just disagree profoundly, because I couldn't even begin to have insight into myself. It weren't for all the, you know, what I'd learned from others.
Yeah, exactly. But it's not a body of knowledge.
What was I doing with Russ yesterday? He was helping me to, you know, to get clearer on in my own. So I mean, you know, I may disagree with some of the things he was suggesting, but that's, you know, if what you were saying was true, it would be totally impossible.
But Steve, you weren't clear about it, and now you are. So you see, millions of people are already clear about the same stuff, but it didn't help you. You had to go all the way to get clear.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think some interesting elements in favour of Mathieu's point here is that at some level there hasn't been progress in understanding the nature of what it is to be human between, let's say, Sophocles, Shakespeare, in McEwen, whatever it is. People face the same problems over again, and it'd be very difficult to say that there's been, you know, we are now way above what Shakespeare was, and he was way above what Sophocles was. Each of them, within the lifetime, acquired a knowledge and understanding of what the nature of.
I would like to bracket that, and actually not necessarily agree with it. By the way,
well, I'm not sure it's true.
Yeah. You know, but secondly, we can't be assumed that you know, self knowledge is unique in that respect, because I think there are all sorts of areas where
I think most of the
faintest idea, and even where we're going backwards.
Well, if you look at the understanding of biology or physics or medicine, I think are clearly cumulative.
No, I disagree. In many respects, I think we maybe understand less about how to, about how to regulate our health than earlier times did. And that's partly because our lives have become more complicated because, you know, our diets have changed, our environments have changed in many ways for the worse. So
I'm not saying our abilities have changed, not that the knowledge hasn't accumulated.
But the two things are interconnected.
Well, people have also
our knowledge and our practice are interconnected.
We've lost knowledge. Herbalism traditions that used to exist in Europe, usually carried by women, have disappeared with women when they were born. And
the same thing is true of, for example, of childbirth. I mean, or maybe things are getting better now that natural childbirth methods have kind of become more widespread. But there was a time when, you know, if you wanted to have a child, you had to go through the sort of this male dominated, you know, it sounds a bit kind of, you know, banging the drum here, but the methods that would have been better for the mother and the child have been lost, have been, you know, completely overrun by the sort of over-scientized...
If I'm understanding what's going on here, which I'm saying is about 50-50, it seems to me that there's that we can change your number one a little bit, which doesn't offend you, excuse me, and solves the problem here. So, in the first place, I don't think there's anything necessary in what you say about number one, that you have to say that this problem is worse in first person than it is in third person.
I didn't say a problem.
Or this situation is stronger or imbalanced or something. I think you can say it's important in third person and it's important in first person. I don't think you have to say more or less. All you have to do is say it's important in first person, I think. But maybe I'm not mistaken. And then, if you do that, and then you don't make that an imperative, you make it a desirability, one of several things that are important, very important actually, that people can individually verify things, but not necessarily that everybody has to verify everything, then doesn't this discussion sort of fall apart and leave you with a perfectly satisfactory position that individual epistemic autonomy is important?
Well, it is also important that this is stronger, because if it is only important as it is in the third person sense, it has implications for what kind of inter-individual regulation can I have. Because in the third person sense, I can have inter-individual regulation in terms of content of my findings. So I can really say your findings are wrong, because I have discovered it for myself that it is wrong, and somebody else also discovered it, and we can regulate somebody to the same. But here, if it is stronger, if it is only, I mean, if I'm really only exploring myself, then I cannot have such kind of inter-individual regulation. Nobody can say that my findings are wrong, because they are not in the same situation. It is the whole situation that matters for me.
Well, maybe the reason that I misunderstood then was, I guess I don't think it's necessary that we just explore you. The first person method isn't me. No, it's just that you would say that.
I don't want you to score me.
But how this bounces off Russ's question, and also something Russ and I were talking about on Terence. How do you stop first-person science becoming stamp collect? Stamp collect, namely, you just go around picking up phenomena.
Yes.
And say, hey, I got one of these. Oh, that's
a possible point.
Huh?
This prevents it. Because if I have an inner motivation, then there is the direction of research unfolds as I go along. If I don't have this, it is just curiosity. I can just, okay, I have this phenomenon. But there are trillions of phenomena,
who's an example of a great first-person scientist? I mean, have we got a model there for someone who knows what to do and has done it successfully and we should all emulate it? Who's that?
Well, no. It seems to me that Henry James.
Well, that's a... Okay. But these exactly... These are sort of joking answers. I mean,
maybe we should give that to James.
Maybe
the best first-person science is literature.
Yeah. I don't know. I could tell you about a lot of examples. I mean, we mentioned Krishnamurti before. I mean, I think he was good. But when I look upon my process of investigation, first-person of investigation of my existential condition, I really see that it has a direction. I don't know in advance where it would go, but when I look at it, I see it had a direction. It was not just collecting stamps, as you said. It had a direction. And it had a direction because it was motivated by something, some different concerns of mine, some existential concerns. If I don't have these existential concerns, then it becomes just collecting stamps. This is the point I want to
make. You know, coming here as an outsider, newcomer to this whole intellectual enterprise, a lot of what everybody's talking about, I get, including what you and Nirvana just put up this afternoon, very useful, but there's something that still doesn't come across clear to me at all. Let's put it this way, I go home after this is over, and I speak to a friend of mine, and I say I've been to a conference about first-person research or scientific investigation, and I, you know, they say, what is that about? I can answer that beautifully, and then the person says, well, what do they do with this stuff? How do they know that they've completed an investigation? Where does it go?
Yeah.
Do they publish? That seems to me to be very nebulous.
I found the quote of Heidegger, and it's the second-hand quote, I mean, somebody quoted Heidegger, I didn't really find that quote, but somebody asked him, what can we do with phenomenology? And he said, it is not a question what we can do with phenomenology, it's a question of what phenomenology can do with us, if we take it seriously. And I think this kind of paradigm shift we have to make if we are serious about first person.
What does that mean?
Totally Delphic.
It doesn't quite mean
it. What is phenomenology going to do
with that? I mean, if you read Husserl,
phenomenology is a method that's out there.
He says somewhere that it's kind of a religious experience. That, I mean, he was changed in the process of investigating his first person.
Okay, but I wouldn't go that far. I would just like to remind everybody that tomorrow we're going to also present a very practical and down-to-earth way what to do with it, or how to do it in group, in internet community. So it's not more, we don't necessarily have to respect religious experience.
We don't have to go as far as religious experience, but I just want to say that the knowledge, the question here is what can knowledge do with me, not what I can do with knowledge as in the first person science, and I can use knowledge to do something. I know how gravity works, and I can use this to let's say break something if I want. I can use this knowledge. But in first person science, the knowledge somehow uses me and changes me. And this is the question I'm after. You want to say correct?
There is, I think there is another type of inter-individual regulation. It's the reproducibility of results. I don't know. In science, it's the main criteria of.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And just I would like to give an example. For example, if two or three teams, different teams, working independently, discover by collecting and comparing the experience of epileptic patients that there is a generic structure before a seizure, sometimes with variance, but something generic. It's a confirmation.
Yes, I understand completely.
Another type of confirmation.
Yes. I understand, and to a certain degree, to a certain extent, I agree with what you're saying. But maybe you know this when this it was popular in this chaos theory of chaos and fractals and so on. It was this question: how long is the coastline of, let's say, California? And then you say, okay, it's so many miles. And then you say, okay, but what kind of measure did you take? Okay, I measured one meter long. What if I take 1 centimeter or 1 inch? Then the coastline becomes really much longer. If I really go around every little stone, it becomes infinite. So, what I want to say is that reproducibility of results. I mean, every event is if we are really accurate. I mean, if you get more and more, we get accurate. More and more, we find that no result is really reproducible. Every result is a unique event, if we are very accurate. So, and what I want to say that what I'm interested in is those situations when you really have to take everything into account. And it is, for my life, I cannot reproduce a result. I cannot, let's say, okay, I fall in love with a girl, and then I want to find out, okay, can I reproduce this result? It will never happen. Because
I hope it will.
I cannot reproduce the same feeling. I cannot really go and say, okay, let's change that condition and see if I fall in love again. It was a unique situation.
Recommendation for kind of autistic life in which everything is unique and you aren't loved, you don't generalize and you don't pull away from it, the reactive picture of the moment to make.
I don't really see that.
If you walk along the road and you tread in some dog poo, are you going to tell me that you can't learn from that? You know, maybe not exactly exactly the same place.
I'm not saying.
Never step in the same dog poo.
How about an example of something you liked or maybe focus on Urban on? Let's say you read Jay Krishnamurti.
You read
a few of his books, and then you do whatever you do, and in that process of your own inquiry, you grok it. You get what Jacob Krishnamurti saw, and you see it for yourself. Is that reproducible or not? Did you reproduce it or not? I understand it's different, but he's not talking about individual phenomena as much as he's trying to talk about something about the nature.
That's a good point. And well, I think I would have to rely on what Panker said before. That he said we can. It's not that it is not possible to reproduce. I mean, it's all about the level of accuracy we are willing to to settle on. But I just want to say that it is not, we cannot make this as an as a imperative that we have to reproduce.
But I don't see how science is, classical science is different, because you never do the same experiment twice. There's different amounts of friction, there's, you know, you cannot exactly reproduce it. But you have general principles that within a certain tolerance will give you similar results. And the same thing can be true for first person. I mean, you can have principles of first person science.
Science, classical science can work to the extent that we are, from in every practical way, willing to settle on a, or it can only work with phenomena that are reversible, that are reproducible.
But even to some extent, first-person phenomena are reproducible. Not exactly, but the general pattern is reproducible.
To
the same extent that it's reproducible in science.
What I want to tackle here is precisely, can we have some knowledge, of what kind of knowledge would that be, of the phenomena that are not reproducible? I am in a particular situation, and I have to do something, and maybe I have a hunch of what to do, and I do it right. And that is a kind of knowledge. And I think we were discussing before what to turn this knowledge, and I found, I don't know the author anymore, but he said, this is knowledge as fact. So it's knowledge as fact. A fact as doing the right thing at the right moment.
Yes.
And you cannot reproduce that. I mean,
yes,
you can.
Yes, the content of your hunch is not reproducible. It's very specific to you. But maybe the structure of the emergence of a hunch maybe comparable, and so if there is something you can describe and compare.
No, but exactly this comparison this comparison might destroy it. I know the really great example of this. That there is a group of people at the I think somebody here is from Sabre Kissinger. Is very much involved in about that are doing the conference organization, the group dynamic stuff and this kind of stuff. And they also have a conference each year, and they notice this really interesting pattern. They notice that first 3 days nothing happened. It's really boring. People are, and then just 1 or 2 days before it ends, it becomes really hot, and you know, things happen, interesting stuff happens, and dynamics starts to flow, and at the end it's a really, really successful conference. So at one point they said, well, we see these dynamics, you know, nothing is happening on the third day, but don't worry, you know, tomorrow it will start happening. Nothing happened, you know. So exactly this is exactly the phenomena where everything adds. New knowledge adds again and changes everything. So it's not, but I would say it's not necessary. It might help, but you should not count on it.
Can I just point out that probably in about 5 minutes we should wrap up? It's quarter after.
It seems to me that there are a lot of things that are not reproducible, and there are some things that are reproducible. And in science that is in as chaotic a state as we are now, it might be a good idea to start with something that is reproducible. And heading in the direction of those things which are quite unique.
Yes, that's the point I wanted to question in the beginning. I mean, is the science we know now, as we know it now, that is only applicable to reproducible phenomena, is this the only kind of science we can have? Can we have a science that has some structure of a science, and this is this key point of this structure that I believe this structure is, that is about phenomena that are not in principle reproducible? And can we have some kind of investigation into this and some kind of knowledge about this that will be totally different probably than the knowledge we are used to have now? This is
there's a journal of irreproducible results.
So maybe there's something about the experience. This is something like what you were saying, Claire, but I'm not sure it's exactly the same. Where you know, let's say you've been doing a certain kind of inquiry, and it's very personal and direct, and it's based on your intention, your strong existential concerns, and you have an experience that seems to you to carry with it a kind of truth value, without worrying too much about what
yeah.
you mean. And then some time passes, and some time later you find yourself having an experience that has the same flavor. Have you reproduced the results? And is that a way, is that a possibility? And then beyond that, could you go to somebody else, perhaps, who you feel has done research here, and find a way of communicating that? And they said, yes, that flavor that you're describing is a good pointer. Is that a possibility for reproducibility?
Yes, I think it is. I think it is. But again, I think it's just safe to say that we should not count on that. We should not make reproducibility of results a criterion for what is knowledge and what is not.
There's a real danger, just to give a little example that Tartan Tulku writes about in the book somewhere, is when you have a certain kind of meditative experience, and what the tendency is to put it inside a little precious box. And then the next time you have an experience, you go and you look at your box and you compare, and you say, no, it wasn't as good, or you say, yes, it's better, and then you make a new box. You know, and you really lose the point. So that is the danger, the great danger.
As the discussion's been going towards the end, there's something that awful specter came to mind, which is that you might have answered to the model for model of a first-person scientist or a first-person scientist. You might have said pride, and the science might have been psychoanalysis. It would have fitted all the things you're talking about, the intent both to move oneself on personally as well as trying to get a handle on the truth of the matter. The importance of individual epistemic autonomy and the training of a psychoanalyst, everyone has to go through the same process. You can't get there by just reading books and so on, you have to do it. The problem of individual regulation and the, on the whole, the rejection of reproducibility has been an interesting criterion for good science. My mother was a psychoanalyst, so I spent a lot of time discussing just these issues with her. If that is model, then, I mean, I don't know whether you'd accept it, and why you wouldn't if you don't want to. But it's very worrying if that's the way we're going. It's like a narcissist is going to turn out to be, you know, what we really would like to be doing.
Well, I don't know that much about technology, but what I know, I don't like very much.
So why? It fulfills so many criteria.
I have first of all, its intention is therapeutic.
Well, no, not entirely at all. No, he's a philosopher as much as him.
Okay, I have this group that we are calling self-knowing group, and we are trying to somehow embody these principles and so on. And there is a guy that really has this tendency of, he's really into psychoanalysis, and he everything that happens, he doesn't allow it really to happen and to unfold, but interprets it beforehand of what it is. And that's why I don't like psychoanalysis.
You must know that Slovenia is like a world center, so you know Žižek.
And I thought it was
so, let me, we have 5 minutes, let me just finish with this. What kind of collective accumulation I could expect if these two points apply? And I think it should be understood in terms of, not in terms of a growing body of knowledge, but in terms of an evolving culture of first-person exploration, both in its normative aspect as well as in its denotative aspect. So there should be some values and some norms about how to do this, and maybe this is something similar that Walt spoke yesterday, that he is concerned about why this let's say religious experience is not a valid topic for discussion in society. I mean, we should change this. We should try to make this a really valid and also valuable topic for discussion. And I think it will happen by itself if we persist on this path, that new language will develop that will be more suitable for describing the discoverers in the first person of the first person inquiry. So with this, this is my third point, but we don't have the time here. So maybe if somebody is interested, we can discuss it in dinner. Maybe I'm more concerned. Okay. That's good. Fine.
Is there any question? We meet again at 7:30 tonight. So we. Yeah.
And that's usual.
On time.
No, then you're going to talk.
Yes, but what I'm doing is. Mostly
experiential
reasoning and some kind of relation. Okay. It's going to be hard. No, I think your time could actually be sort of a
structure. I think that there are thousands of different traditions that have their own, and there is no single one of knowledge like there is in science.
And what we did earlier,
each point has a cup of glasses.
No, so we should have a question about that.
How can we? I
mean, something myself actually. There might be new principles. There will be new principles.
It's going to raise up a measure of value.
Which we don't have in this right now. But it would be a
So, Madam Butterfly, for example, is structured in such a way that you experience the same thing that thousands of other people experience exactly the same way. Or another example is the technology of advertising, where they are inducing certain discomfort, certain longings.
But I'm saying that it's useful. It could be useful. We don't know how to use it. I don't think that means what you mean.
Better analogy.
There's a video
in
the clinical trial and the
SpaceX was a question, but I think it looked like what
the Voyager space.
We're accepting its results without needing to launch another Voyager spacecraft.
And you cannot
let me clear it as well.
Right. So likewise, if we're exploring on terminal, we can report the results.
You will just copy that.
No, when you get to the point where they're living, for example, there's a child. I see.